if all goes well, it could lead to not only flattened production, but also increased production.
A Papua New Guinea company takes over one of the state's biggest oil fields. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, division in the House stalls progress on the budget.
They had the plan, they had the votes, they were all aligned on Alaska's future, and we're seeing now that that alignment is not there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m., only on Alaska Public Media TV.
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is beginning work on a lease sale next year in Arctic waters, even though the larger plan for offshore leasing is still a draft proposal. BOEM announced today that it's issuing a formal call for information and nominations about the Beaufort Sea. The agency is seeking comments on which parts of the Beaufort should be open to drilling and which areas are sensitive or important to subsistence activities. The Beaufort and most other American waters were included in the draft of the five-year offshore leasing plan the Interior Department announced in January. But the plan has not been approved yet. Environmental groups say the Trump administration is taking a shortcut on the public process.
This is not how the federal government's supposed to work.
Lois Epstein is with the Wilderness Society. She says the public comment period for the five-year plan just ended. And Epstein points out there's a lawsuit challenging the removal of the Obama administration's ban on offshore Arctic drilling.
They're pre-deciding the outcome of what they're going to find when they carefully evaluate all the comments and when they carefully evaluate the results of the litigation.
The agency says each lease sale takes a great deal of advance planning. BOEM spokesman John Callahan says it's routine for the government to begin work on any sale expected in the first year of a five-year plan before the plan is actually approved. A new company is taking charge of what could be one of the biggest future oil developments in Alaska. The company, Oil Search, is entirely new to Alaska, but the company argues its experience in a tropical island nation will come in handy as it starts work in the Arctic. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
Before we get into who is drilling it and why, let's make one thing clear about this oil field. The state of Alaska thinks it's a very big deal. Here's Natural Resources Commissioner Andy Mack.
Literally, if you kind of line up the big fields up on the North Slope, this probably ranks third behind Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk.
Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, of course, are the giant oil fields responsible for making Alaska the oil state it is today. And on a chunk of state and native-owned land west of Prudhoe Bay, one company thinks there might be over a billion barrels of recoverable oil. Mack says that alone could reverse the long-term decline in the amount of oil flowing down the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
If all goes well, it could lead to not only flattened production, but also increased production.
So last fall, when a company a lot of Alaskans hadn't heard of moved to take over developing this oil field, it got people's attention. Oil Search is a company based in Papua New Guinea, a country just south of the equator and just north of Australia, where the company also has offices. An oil project in the Arctic may seem like an odd leap for a company from an island nation in the South Pacific, but the newly minted president of Oil Search Alaska, Kieran Wolf, says the company is serious about its new venture.
When we look at Alaska, we see Alaska as a place of enormous opportunity.
Wolf says Oil Search's first planned development in Alaska could represent a major investment for the company, in the range of $4 to $6 billion. The company bought a significant stake in the project last year from its main partner, Denver-based Armstrong Oil and Gas. And last week, Oil Search officially took over as operator of the field. That means when it comes to actually getting an oil development off the ground, Oil Search is in the driver's seat. Sitting in the conference room of the company's new offices in downtown Anchorage, Wolf makes it clear Oil Search is gearing up for what could be something big.
So we've just taken the whole floor here. We're actually expanding so that we can fit over 120 people on this floor, and the majority of them will be Alaskans.
So why is Oil Search in Alaska? The company operates all the producing oil fields in Papua New Guinea, but the bulk of what it's invested in there is gas. So the company decided it needed to balance its portfolio. True to its name, Wolf says Oil Search came to Alaska searching for more oil. It might not seem like Papua New Guinea and Alaska have much in common, but Wolf says his company sees a lot of similarities.
Papua New Guinea is one of the most challenging environment places to work on planet. It's very remote, very mountainous. There are no roads. There is no infrastructure to speak of. And everything has to be brought in on helicopters and such.
Beyond logistics, Wolf says Oil Search also has experience negotiating with local communities living near where the company wants to drill. Wolf thinks in some ways, communities in Papua New Guinea and communities on the North Slope have similar values.
Very passionate about their environment, very passionate about their way of life. And so an important part there, and a lot strong analogy between Papua New Guinea and Alaska is the commitment and the passion of the local community to their areas. And that's something you've got to respect and be very cognizant of.
However, Wolf says Oil Search's discussions with Nuiqsut, the community closest to the company's first planned development, are still in their infancy. And that's not the only issue that needs to be ironed out. Oil Search wants to drill a few more appraisal wells to get a better idea of how much oil it's actually sitting on.
Look, I think it's a long way to go before people understand how big this field is. Our company is quite a conservative company. We don't over-promote, we don't over-promise. Our style is much more to sort of under-promise and over-deliver.
Depending on whether and how all the details come together, it's possible that by 2023, a Papua New Guinea company could begin producing from one of the biggest oil developments in Alaska's history. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The Alaska House hasn't taken any actions regarding the budget since Monday. That's when the body more than doubled the size of the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman joins me now to tell us about what's put a stop to the budget movement. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
So today is day 72 in the session. That doesn't leave much time for the legislature to finish its work. Why hasn't the House taken action on the budget?
It goes back to the debate on restoring full PFD funding that began on Friday and ended on Monday. The House voted 21-19 to set the PFD at roughly $2,700. The vote split both caucuses, but it was particularly difficult for the majority. 9 majority caucus Democrats and majority Republican Gabrielle Ledoux voted to restore the PFD to its full amount. They say it's wrong to cut PFDs until wealthier Alaskans or companies chip in to close the budget gap. But 8 Democrats and 4 other majority caucus members, 2 Republicans and 2 independents, voted no. They say a lower dividend is more responsible and it helps future dividends. It does that by maintaining savings. Since the majority didn't agree on a dividend, it can't agree right now on the overall size of the budget. The added dividend money cost almost $900 million.
Andrew, how significant is the divide in the House majority?
Lori, right now it looks like it is pretty significant. And it's opened up the majority to criticism. Here's House Minority Leader Sharice Millett.
This were Republicans organized with the Democrats and the independents because they had the plan, they had the votes, they were all aligned on Alaska's future, and we're seeing now that that alignment is not there. And, unfortunately, when you are in leadership and you are the speaker and, it's your obligation with 22 people to get a budget passed with 21. And this is just the first step.
Millett says the minority is open to working with the majority on a budget, but it would take significant cuts to the budget that the majority so far hasn't accepted.
Well, what about the majority? What are you hearing there?
House Speaker Bryce Edgman took questions from the media today. I asked him about what Millett had said, and he responded that he wouldn't be criticizing the minority in the media. Edgman says the majority is working to come to a consensus on both the size of the budget and the PFD. Edgman says the closeness of the PFD vote shows a growing sense that PFDs will have to be lower as part of a broader budget solution.
I count it as being historic because a couple of years ago, for many of you who have been around the Capitol, that vote easily could have been 35-5 as opposed to 21-19, if it had even come to the floor at all. So things are changing in Alaska.
Edgman says the dividend level is one of several elements to solve the state's budget problem. He voted for the full PFD, and he noted that some of his southwestern Alaska constituents are among those with the lowest incomes. The House held what's called a technical floor session today, in which it didn't take any action.
So nothing happened in the House today. Do you anticipate that there will be some action tomorrow?
It's too early to say. Until the majority reaches agreement on some of these big budget questions, I wouldn't expect any action. Edgman says the House will send the budget to the Senate, quote, soon, end quote, but he wouldn't say exactly when.
All right, Andrew, thank you for keeping an eye on what's happening in Juneau for us.
You're welcome, Laurie.
That was Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reporting from Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how the president's proposed tariffs could hit Alaskan breweries.
People think about aluminum as being important for the beer industry, but steel is very important for us as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Anchorage is conducting its first ever election through mail-in ballots. Residents are being asked to vote on a long list of measures, including a controversial bathroom ordinance, the complex sale of a utility, and several bond and tax proposals. At the top of all of that is the choice for the city's next mayor. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the two major candidates are focused on the same central issues, but have divergent stances.
Though there are technically 9 people who have filed paperwork to run for mayor, only 2 have raised significant sums of money and mounted visible campaigns. Incumbent Ethan Berkowitz and challenger Rebecca Logan appeared on Alaska Public Media's television program Alaska Insight recently.
Welcome to both of you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us here.
Both Berkowitz and Logan have framed crime and the economy as the campaign's main issues. Berkowitz is casting a potential second term as a continuance of policies he's pursued the last 3 years. In her campaign, Logan has differentiated herself by running further to the right, offering a more hardline vision for policing, including tougher treatment of lower-level crimes like petty theft, shoplifting, and vandalism.
That's what's seeming to cause, I think, the most fear with people, because that's what an Anchorage citizen on a daily basis is subject to, those types of things. And so you have to have a zero-tolerance policy there, meaning arresting those people and keeping them in jail.
Berkowitz has made expansion of the Anchorage Police Department a central policy of his tenure and says the administration's recruitment targets are one piece of a long-term strategy.
Are we getting as far as we need to go as quickly as we can? No, but there's also a recognition that this is not just a law enforcement problem.
Berkowitz points to a multitude of public safety factors all at play in the city's struggle with crime. Diminished state resources, the impacts to local departments from the criminal justice overhaul in Senate Bill 91, and the opioid epidemic. Berkowitz says the city's approach to substance abuse needs to include expanded treatment options by collaborating with private and nonprofit partners. In one of their biggest policy differences, Logan does not support expanding drug treatment, saying the majority of people addicted to opioids are engaging in criminal activity and thinks rehabilitation should be part of incarceration.
You know, what's happening is that people get arrested for committing a crime, they've got a drug problem, and there's never a break in the cycle because they're getting out on bail, right? They aren't even spending any time in prison. So I think that people have to have rehabilitation and treatment as part of a sentence, and that it's mandatory.
On the local economy, Logan says policies should emphasize businesses that are currently in Anchorage without overtaxing or overregulating them. In a question on municipal finances, Logan criticized the current administration's budget, but offered no specific programming cuts or alternative revenue sources.
So we've got to be really careful about our spending level and making sure that we keep that under control so that we don't go straight to the property taxpayers looking for taxes.
For his part, Berkowitz says the administration has worked to shore up city finances as state funds have dried up.
Our focus has been on finding new revenue sources, which includes things like diversifying the income stream, reducing the tax burden on property tax owners. We're also looking for ways to raise revenue from enterprises. That includes the sale of MLMP to Chugach.
That utility sale is on the ballot and needs voter approval in order to eventually be finalized. Though the mayor's race in Anchorage is technically nonpartisan, the two candidates' fundraising disclosures are filled with familiar players in the state's party politics. In the latest filings, Berkowitz, a former Democratic state representative, had raised $221,000, more than twice what his challenger brought in. Among the donors are political action committees for organized labor and public safety employees, several current and former assembly members, public employees, and individuals aligned with the state's Democratic Party. Almost half of that money has been spent down in the last month, much of it on media buys, ad placement, and polling. Logan, who is the CEO of an oil and gas industry support group, had raised $89,000 and spent all but $3,000 of it. Her donors include many individuals from the resource development sector, prominent conservative activists, Republican groups, as well as former Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan. Both candidates expressed general support for the city's inaugural election conducted by mail-in ballots, though Berkowitz says nobody's quite sure what it'll do to voter turnout.
And I say that because I didn't anticipate being part of the guinea pig election.
Both candidates say they will vote against Proposition 1, the proposal to modify the city's existing laws and begin regulating public bathrooms and changing facilities according to biological sex at birth rather than a person's self-identified gender. The last day to cast ballots is April 3rd. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
For more information on Anchorage's vote by mail or to watch Alaska Public Media's latest episode of Alaska Insight focused on the election, visit our website, alaskapublic.org/alaskainsight. As the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs take effect, one Southeast Alaska business is unsure how it will affect them. The Alaskan Brewing Company employs about 100 people making beer in Juneau. KTOO's David Purdy visited their manufacturing operation to find out more.
Past the shining steel tanks that brew the beer, the canning line of the Alaskan Brewing Company is humming along. A pallet full of empty aluminum cans is loaded into a machine that feeds them into the almost fully automatic assembly line. They slide down a series of conveyor belts, and along the way, they're washed, filled, sealed, and finally packed into boxes. The brewery buys those empty cans, ready to fill, from another manufacturer.
We're sort of almost an end user. We're not quite the end user drinking the beer, but we're almost an end user of that aluminum.
Andy Klein is the communications director for the Alaskan Brewing Company in Juneau.
We don't directly pay that raw material cost, so that's the other thing that's hard to predict, what the multiplier effect of a raw material cost will cost to us kind of buying an end product.
Klein says the price of steel actually concerns him just as much as aluminum.
The kind of obvious thing, the thing that's in the consumer's hand is an aluminum can, so people think about aluminum as being important for the beer industry. But steel is very important for us as well.
The two-story vats that brew the beer and the maze of pipes connecting them are all made of stainless steel. So expanding the brewery's infrastructure means a lot of money goes into steel. But Klein doesn't seem too worried. He says, making beer in Alaska, the brewery is no stranger to unusual supply chain concerns.
We're in one of the most unique positions in the United States for a beer supplier that's also supplying 20 states throughout the mostly West Coast and Midwest of the United States. Every single thing we get in, 98% about of all of our materials are brought in by barge.
The remote location means being flexible and creative. A few years ago, for instance, the brewery started taking the spent grain that's left over after the brewing process and burning it for fuel. Before that, they had to ship it out to dispose of in the lower 48. So why make beer in a place with so many unusual challenges? For the brewery, it's practically a founding principle. In fact, showcasing the manufacturing possibilities of Alaska is right there in their mission statement.
We're going to make beer in Juneau, rest assured.
Klein says they don't foresee any specific changes. There's no plans for price increases or big layoffs. For now, they're just keeping an eye out for any impact the tariffs might have. In Juneau, I'm David Purdy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
The U.S. Forest Service controls 22 million acres in Alaska, including most of Southeast. It's overseen by a regional forester whose staffers manage logging, mining, recreation, and fish habitat. The agency is getting a new top official in April. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, that person will have to deal with a particularly controversial land management plan that is under attack.
David Schmidt began his Forest Service career in Alaska. He and his wife moved here in the early 1980s for his first agency job in South Central's Chugach National Forest. Later, he worked in the Tongass in Southeast.
Over the years, I think we spent 23 years together in Alaska, and just having an opportunity to come back and re-engage with folks and work on Alaska issues has just been a dream of mine.
He's leaving his post as deputy regional forester for the agency's northern region based in Missoula, Montana. He'll take over the Alaska job from regional forester Beth Pendleton, who's retiring after 8 years in the position. She spent about 30 years in the Forest Service, two-thirds of it in Alaska. Pendleton recently served as acting associate chief of the nationwide agency during the transition to the Trump administration. Despite shakeups at the top, she says there was no pressure to leave.
My plans to retire were in 2018, so this is, per my choice to retire at this time.
Pendleton oversaw the Forest Service's Alaska region during development of the most recent Tongass Land Management Plan. It's been challenged in court and in Congress, largely because it begins the phase-out of old-growth logging. She believes the plan will survive because it's flexible and can absorb change.
We've been really focusing on that transition to young growth harvest and renewable energy, and there is an adaptive management component that's associated with the plan where there's room based on our learning and adaptive management approach to further amend the plan in the future if needed.
Pendleton says she'll bring her replacement up to speed before she leaves the office. Schmidt hasn't been part of this version of the Tongass planning battle, but he's familiar with the issues from his days as district ranger for Thorne Bay on Prince of Wales Island. Before the big mills closed, it was a center of Alaska's timber industry. Schmidt says he's dealt with similar conflicts in his current job.
I think I've had, something like 75 or 80 objection resolution meetings here in Montana, northern Idaho, and North Dakota. And oftentimes, mostly around travel planning or large vegetation management, I would say it was almost identical to my experiences in Alaska with some very polarized issues.
A Forest Service press release announcing the transition says Schmidt will be acting regional forester, but he says he'll be here for the long haul. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
In Nome, people keep warm in a variety of ways. They collect driftwood along the beach in the summer months, and heating fuel arrives by barge in the summer and fall. In 2012, an early storm prevented an oil tanker from making that delivery. But as the Bering Strait becomes more accessible, the mayor of Nome says there's an upside to less sea ice. Reporter Elizabeth Jenkins stopped by Richard Benneville's house to hear more as part of the Cost of Cold series from Alaska's Energy Desk. He spends $250 heating his house every month of the year with diesel.
And my house that I rent, my little house that we're in right now, my little nest, is heated by two monitors or, Toyo stoves or something. But I took a $250 increase per month when I took the place. I choose not to supply my own fuel. I'm a lazy renter, and I'm not good at those sort of things. I can't change my own oil. That's why I go to a mechanic. All of our fuel comes in during the summer. So aviation, heating fuel, unleaded, all of that comes in during the summer months. We haven't had in the last 10 years, we've had 30 below a couple of times. Although you're looking out there today, you'd never know it. But the ice that's formed out there is about a foot less thick than it used to be 25 years ago. Water temperature's up, so it's here. What is happening with the Bering Strait is a precursor of the future, which is more transportation, more goods coming across both Northeast and Northwest passages, which will, from my mouth to God's ears, mean less cost for us on a lot of these things, like heating fuel and milk. So that's the future, Hello Central. But the problem being here, ocean levels rising, villages that have to move, it's without consequences. That's my kitty cat, who wants to be heard from. It's a happy cat. He's warm. He's toasty. Are you upstaging me, you little noom? Huh? I've been recently thinking of buying a place. Why do I want to buy? I'm 73 years old. I've never owned a home. So many Americans have, hundreds of thousands of dollars in mortgages and debts and all of that. Well, I don't have any, which I guess is a good thing if you look at it another way. I'm happy, and I have an ocean view.
The Cost of Cold is a series from Alaska's Energy Desk about how Alaskans around the state heat their homes. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and David Purdy in Juneau, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.